Kennedy then asked me to go with him to a party he had been invited to at a private home. I accepted but felt self-conscious in my golfing clothes in front of about 100 people, including many well-known socialites who wintered in Palm Beach. Then the president-elect popped another surprise on me. "Billy, there are about 300 media people at the Washington Hotel I've not seen since I have been down here. I have got to say a word to them. Would you mind going with me?" I felt honored. At the hotel, I sat among the press, prepared to listen to the president-elect's comments. He started by saying that he had been playing golf with me and joked about our scores. Then the surprise. "I want to present to you Dr. Billy Graham, who's going to answer some questions." That was the first I'd heard about that. I went up to the podium, and the press dived into the religious controversy that had been so prominent during the campaign, and about which I had kept quiet. Though Mr. Kennedy was using me for his own purposes, I did not mind finally speaking out. I said, "I don't think that Mr. Kennedy's being a Catholic should be held against him by any Protestant. They should judge him on his ability and his character. We should trust and support our new president." If I had said that before the election, I'm convinced I would have been in trouble. But the statement seemed justified now. I was interviewed for a half hour or more. The dawn of the 1960s was a terribly difficult time for any world leader. I was encouraged that President Kennedy took the trouble to attend the annual presidential prayer breakfast each of his 3 years in Washington. I was the speaker each of those years. I learned later that Mr. Kennedy had reportedly said I was the only Protestant clergyman with whom he felt comfortable. Several times during the Kennedy years, I was invited to the White House, though never to a state dinner or to his personal quarters. I remember several occasions in the Oval Office, one visit especially, when he asked me to tell how I talked through an interpreter. Apparently, he had seen me on a TV program talking through an interpreter in Latin America, and he liked the style and method, which was sentence by sentence. The last time I was with Kennedy was at the 1963 National Prayer Breakfast. I had the flu. "Mr. President, I don't want to give you this bug that I've got, so I'm not going to talk right at your face." "Oh, I don't mind," he said. "I talk to a lot of people all day long who've got all kinds of bugs." After I gave my short talk and he gave his, we walked out of the hotel to his car together, as was always our custom. At the curb, he turned to me. "Billy, could you ride back to the White House with me? I would like to see you for a minute." "Mr. President, I've got a fever," I protested. "Not only am I weak, but I don't want to give you this thing. Couldn't we wait and talk some other time?" It was a cold, snowy day, and I was freezing as I stood there without my overcoat. "Of course," he said graciously. His hesitation at the car door and his request haunt me still. What was on his mind? Should I have gone with him? It was an irrecoverable moment. Governor John Conley, a Democrat at the time, invited me to Texas to participate in his inauguration as governor on January 15, 1963. In late fall of that year, when I was back preaching in Houston, the governor came to my hotel room. He confided that he was concerned about President Kennedy's forthcoming trip to Texas in November. He said there was much hostility against the president in Texas, and feared a lukewarm or even a negative response. Sometime toward the end of the second week in November, I unaccountably felt such a burden about the presidential visit to Dallas that I decided to phone our mutual friend, Senator Smathers, to tell him I really wanted to talk to the president. His secretary told me Senator Smathers was on the Senate floor and would call me back. Instead, he sent me a telegram that the president would get in touch with me directly. He thought I wanted to talk about the president's invitation to another golf game in Florida that weekend. The game was off, he said, and would have to be rescheduled. But all I wanted to tell him and the president was one thing: don't go to Texas. I had an inner foreboding that something terrible was going to happen. I told this to T.W. and Calvin Thielman, pastor of the Montreat Presbyterian Church, while we were on the golf course one day and before I put through the call to Smathers. But was such a strange feeling enough to justify the president's attention? In the early afternoon of November 22nd, I was playing golf with T.W., Lee Fisher, and Cliff Barrows at the local course in Black Mountain, North Carolina. We had just teed off for the fifth hole right next to the road when Lauren Bridges, manager of WFGW, the Christian radio station we owned there, drove up and shouted that the president had been shot. Just then, the Black Mountain golf pro, Ross Taylor, came running, shouting the same news. We rushed to the WFGW studio, where dispatches were clacking over the wires. Lauren handed me the latest Associated Press teletype copy. The report was sketchy. Hard information about the president's condition was not available yet. I asked Calvin Thielman to go on the air with me to pray for Kennedy and his family and to read scripture. I also asked T.W. to call a friend of ours who was a doctor at Parkland Memorial Hospital in Dallas to get the latest word. As Calvin and I went on the air, T.W. came to the control room window and held a scrap of paper up against the glass. He is dead. I dared not break such news to Western North Carolina until a public announcement was made, which Walter Cronkite did over CBS 3 or 4 minutes later. Then Calvin and I spoke of the president and prayed for his family and for the new president, Lyndon Baines Johnson. At the president's funeral the following Monday in St. Matthew's Cathedral in Washington, I was invited to sit among friends of the Kennedy family. The question on everybody's mind was, why did it happen? Like everyone else, I was touched by the sight of their children, Caroline and John Jr. When John and I got acquainted decades later, I was struck by his resemblance to his father, both in personality and ability. Although people who are constantly in the public eye usually learn to shield their inner thoughts, they have the same personal problems and questions that we do. Sometimes such people have felt free to talk intimately with me, knowing that I would hold their remarks in confidence. Some of them have had serious character flaws, and when I've been aware of those, I've tried to do what I could, speaking to them privately and pastorally from the standpoint of the Bible's moral standards. You and Ruth must be here for our library dedication May 22nd. That was retired President Lyndon Johnson's handwritten postscript at the bottom of a typewritten note to me dated February 23, 1971, slightly more than 2 years after leaving office. For that occasion in Austin, we were invited by President Nixon to accompany him on Air Force One. I gave the invocation. After the ceremony, LBJ took Ruth and me out to his ranch in the hill country. Over the years, we had enjoyed many good visits with him and Lady Bird on that sprawling land under the vast Texas sky, and we were glad to be back. He and I walked down to the oak trees, edging the Pedernales River, which flanked the family cemetery. Usually effervescent, he struck me as subdued that day. "Billy," he said, "one day you're going to preach at my funeral. You will stand right under this tree. I will be buried right there. You will read the Bible, of course, and preach the gospel. I want you to." He paused for a moment. "But I hope you will also tell folks some of the things I tried to do." When the time came, I did not find it a hard assignment. Ours was that kind of friendship. At the graveside service on January 25, 1973, less than 2 years after that conversation, I described him as history in motion and a mountain of a man with a whirlwind for a heart, whose 38 years of public service kept him at the center of the events that have shaped our destiny. If anything, those words, as I look at them now, were an understatement. LBJ was a powerful, gigantic personality whose charisma dominated a room the minute he entered it. The focus of attention and even balance of power automatically shifted to him. He could be coarse and charming at the same time, and even profanely poignant. Almost every time he swore in my presence, he would quickly turn and say, "Excuse me, preacher." Although many have commented on his complex character, perhaps I saw a side of that complexity that others didn't see, for LBJ had a sincere and deeply felt, if simple, spiritual dimension. Yet I was beside him many times as he knelt by his bedside in his pajamas, praying to one mightier than he. I saw strength in that, not weakness. Great men know when to bow. On Sunday, December 15th, less than 3 weeks after President Kennedy's funeral, the telephone rang just as I was preparing to leave for Annapolis, where I was to speak in the chapel of the United States Naval Academy. "This is Lyndon," the President's familiar voice boomed, adding that he wanted me to come by the White House. The next day we spent several hours together, talking and swimming in the White House pool. The earth-shaking events of the last few weeks had clearly sobered him. We prayed together, and I asked God to give him special grace and wisdom in the difficult days ahead. Afterward, he invited me to offer a prayer of thanks at a small dinner honoring the executive staff of the New York Herald Tribune. As the new president in February 1964, he spoke at the National Prayer Breakfast. "No man can live where I live, nor work at the desk where I work now, without needing and seeking the strength and support of earnest and frequent prayer." Those were no words of a desperate man on a sinking ship. They revealed faith in a friend who could help. I knew he was not a saint. When I spoke warmly about his spiritual convictions, I was not forgetting his inconsistencies and transgressions. Did he intimidate me? Maybe just the opposite. I think I intimidated him a little. He liked having an old-fashioned Baptist preacher around for personal as well as political reasons. But I did not avoid taking issue with him or probing his soul whenever I thought it necessary. At a gathering of police chiefs in Kansas City in September 1967, for example, I was present to hear his address. That evening, when I spoke at our crusade meeting in the municipal stadium, I said I disagreed with some of the things he had said that morning. "I'm going to tell you what I believe the Bible teaches." The media picked that up in a hurry. A preacher setting the president straight, and in public at that? LBJ phoned me the next day. "What is the matter with you?" he grumbled. "I thought you were my friend." "I am," I replied, "but I can't always agree with everything you say." He changed the subject and didn't bring it up again. LBJ was impulsive and unpredictable. His speech could be as overbearing as his behavior. From my reading about past presidents, I would say he was in the same mold as Andrew Jackson, rough and brilliant with plenty of natural ability. In an earlier generation, he would have qualified as one of Theodore Roosevelt's rough riders. One time when Ruth and I were visiting the ranch, LBJ took Lady Bird and us for a boat ride. It seemed he went the same speed on the water as in a car, as he careened around water skiers, his wife shouting, "Lyndon, slow down! I thought he was going to capsize and kill us all." By the time we got back, it was dark, but he had another suggestion. "While they're getting dinner ready, let me take you for a ride in a car I've got out here." I was still a little shaky from the boat ride, but Ruth and I climbed into the vehicle, and we took off at full throttle. We sped along a riverbank. Without warning, he swerved right into the Pertinalis. For a second, I believed he was suicidal. But the engine kept going, and so did we. The car turned out to be an amphibious vehicle that carried us along on the current like a boat. "Most people jump out when we hit the water," Johnson complained, as Ruth remembered it. "You were the president," she said to him. "I figured you knew what you were doing." Johnson loved to catch people off guard or throw them off balance, and not only while driving on the ranch. I was the president's guest when at the White House at federal budget time one year. "Billy, I do not know how long I will be in there. You take these pencils and see if you can trim a few billion off this budget while I am gone." I opened the huge, thick notebook and reviewed the American government budget. By the time he had returned, I had actually inflated it a little, thinking he needed to spend a little more here and a little more there. He roared, "You would have made a good congressman." He could also be kind and generous, very solicitous when it came to our comfort and well-being. If he found out I was staying at a hotel in Washington, he would call to say, "There will be a car there in 15 minutes. Your hotel is over here." One Saturday evening when we were visiting, the Johnsons had to go out. That left Ruth and me alone at the White House. Nobody else was there, it seemed, and most of the lights were out. Ruth and I walked all over the place, turning lights on wherever we could find a switch. That was as much power as I ever exercised in the White House. In 1964, the Scripps Howard newspapers came out with a front-page story announcing that I was giving serious consideration to running for president. Some Republicans phoned me to say they had enough support to nominate me. I did not think they knew what a good friend of Lyndon Johnson's I was, or they would have thought twice before talking to me. My father-in-law, Dr. Bell, got in touch with me in a hurry. "It is on all the newscasts. You have got to call a press conference and stop it. It must be T.W.'s fault. He talked you into considering this." So much for family support. When Ruth called me later, she echoed her father's message. T.W. had nothing to do with it, of course. I had been urged by a few friends to think about it, but how it leaked out, I would never know. First thing the next morning, I convened a press conference. "Under no circumstances am I going to run for president," I said. "Like General Sherman, if nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not serve. God called me to preach." Ruth and I were having lunch with the President and Lady Bird at the White House when the 1964 Democratic Convention was starting in Atlantic City. He handed me a list of 14 names. "Now, who would you choose as a running mate?" I started to answer, but then winced in pain. Instead of taking the hint, I asked Ruth why she had kicked me. "Yes, Ruth, why?" asked the President. She turned to me. "You should limit yourself to moral and spiritual advice, not political advice." "Ruth," said the President, "that is exactly right." When Ruth and Lady Bird left the room after lunch, Johnson closed the door behind them. "All right," he said. "Now, what do you really think?" I smiled and pointed to one name on his list, more guessing than advising. He nodded. The Hubert Humphrey decision had already been made. As for my preacher relationship to Johnson, it became very direct at times. At his ranch one evening, he and I sat in his convertible watching a glorious sunset. "Mr. President, have you ever personally, definitely, received Jesus Christ as your Savior?" "Well, Billy, I think I have." "When someone says that, Mr. President," I said carefully, "I don't feel too sure of it." He looked at me with a puzzled expression. "It's a once-for-all transaction," I said. "You receive Christ and He saves you. His Spirit bears witness with your spirit that you're a child of God." He nodded, but I did not feel that this was the time to say more, but I knew he would be thinking about what I had said. Hardly ever did I leave without his saying, "Preacher, pray for me." Then he would get down on his knees, whether we were in the ranch house or the White House. Johnson's dream was the Great Society. Of course, much of it made up of the programs Kennedy had not been able to get through Congress. I am convinced that LBJ genuinely loved the minorities and the poor. He wanted to correct injustice, to see everybody in America housed and fed. "That is what I think Jesus would do," was an expression I heard from him more than once. He thought the best expression of his faith was to help humankind. I was heartsick to read in later biographies of his apparent moral failures. Whatever he might have been guilty of, I was sure he loved Lady Bird and his daughters Linda and Lucy. His wife, in turn, was loving and loyal to a larger-than-life husband. He knew he could depend on her because she had tremendous strength of her own. Lady Bird was one of the most remarkable first ladies ever. Some years later, when I was in Austin, I phoned her to say hello. She and Lucy then drove to the airport in person to pick me up and take me to their home. Lady Bird had a strength and dignity that was never adequately portrayed to the American people. It's been my experience that all the first ladies had more influence on their husbands than most people have realized. I tried to be a spiritual counselor to Lyndon Johnson, but I was not his confessor. He said to me that he had done a lot of things of which he was ashamed, though he refused to go into detail. He was, however, able to express his belief, "I believe I am saved and that I will spend eternity in heaven." Nothing I knew personally about him contradicted that. Christ came to save the sinners, not the righteous, as he himself said. One thing the president did confide in me, though, a full year before his term ended, was his decision to not run again. Protests against the Vietnam War, a war he inherited, had taken their toll on his morale. But that was not the chief factor, nor was the candidacy of Robert Kennedy. LBJ was not afraid of any competitor except one, death. Like Winston Churchill, LBJ often received visitors while in bed. He would read, keep his eyes on three TVs, and have a private conversation all at the same time. "Billy," he said one morning in his bedroom, "most all my relatives and ancestors died in their 60s of heart trouble. I have already had one heart attack, and I have chest pains now that I do not tell my doctor about. I am not going to run next time because it would not be fair to the American people. It would not be fair to my family. It would not be fair to me." Needless to say, I kept that confidential. President Johnson and I often talked about the Vietnam War, but never about the military strategy involved. He felt we had to get out of it, and he asked me, along with everyone he knew, just how such a thing could be accomplished. "Every time I see a casualty list," he once said to me about the servicemen, "I feel for their fathers and mothers, and sometimes I call them on the phone just to talk to them personally." I made two trips to Vietnam to preach to the troops with a few members of my team during LBJ's presidency, in 1966 and again in 1968, both during the Christmas season. When I arrived in Vietnam during one of our trips, reporters climbed all over me, trying to learn whether or not I supported the president's policy. My answer was always the same. "My only desire is to minister to our troops by my prayers and spiritual help wherever I can." Bob Hope asked us to join up with him and his company, who were entertaining the troops in Vietnam with their Christmas program. After each show, Bob and his troop went back to the safety of Bangkok. I and my group, which included Cliff and Bev, stayed in Vietnam. Some wit was quick to quip that the difference between Bob and me was that he had the hope, but I had the faith. The last weekend the Johnsons were in the White House, before Nixon's first inauguration in 1969, Ruth and I were their only guests. Our daughter Anne and her husband Danny Lotz joined us as we walked together through quiet rooms emptied of personal possessions. We attended church together, and on Monday I gave an inaugural prayer at the Capitol. As the distinguished guests on the platform followed President Nixon out after the swearing-in, the two Johnson girls, Linda and Lucy, broke protocol when they stopped in the line and kissed me. Some said I was instrumental in the transfer of authority from Johnson to Nixon. As a friend to both, I might have said or done some things that helped in the transition, but I served in no official or even implied capacity. I'll always treasure a letter Johnson wrote when he got back to Texas. "No one will ever fully know how you helped to lighten my load or how much warmth you brought into our house. My mind went back to those lonely occasions at the White House when your prayers and your friendship helped to sustain a president in an hour of trial. If that was so, it was a great privilege for me." Once out of office, Johnson was much more relaxed. On one occasion in 1970, we were driving all over his ranch as usual, raising dust because of a long dry spell. "Billy," he said, "how about offering a little prayer for rain?" I took him seriously and prayed briefly. No sooner had I finished than a couple of drops hit the windshield. In minutes, it was raining so hard, the president stopped the car and turned to me again. "Billy, we're going to have a flood. I've got two pumps down in the river that are going to wash away. See if you cannot stop it." I laughed and assured him it was out of my hands. In the 1972 election, Johnson, in my opinion, was secretly in favor of Nixon. He called me one day just after the Democratic running mates, George McGovern and Sergeant Shriver, had visited him at the ranch. "Billy, they are just now leaving. I want to tell you some things to pass on to our mutual friend." He met Nixon, of course, and his major piece of advice was that Richard Nixon should aggressively ignore McGovern during the campaign. "Tell him to respond to nothing McGovern says. Act as if he is not even a factor." Some would say LBJ was being a disloyal Democrat, but I suspect he considered his party's 1972 ticket too liberal to fully support. LBJ's premonition of his own death was right on the mark. He died of heart disease early in 1973. Lady Bird called and asked which service I would like to speak at, the funeral in Washington or the burial in Austin. I told her of his request, and we settled on the burial. At the gravesite, John Conley delivered the eulogy. I gave a short sermon in which I spoke of President Johnson's accomplishments and pointed to the hope we have in Christ because of his resurrection from the dead. As I spoke my tribute and shared God's words of comfort, I looked at the flag-draped casket under the yokes by the Pernalis and thought, here, indeed, was a Texan who was tall timber. Like every other administration, his will get mixed reviews from historians. But historians will never be able to ignore LBJ. His great society did not accomplish all that he hoped, but for him personally, it was more than a dream. He wanted to harness the wealth and knowledge and greatness of this nation to help the poor and the oppressed here and around the world. That hope must be revived by every president and kept alive in the hearts of all citizens. It was 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning, but I was most definitely not in church. Instead, to the horror of some, I was attending the 1969 Miami Rock Music Festival. America in 1969 was in the midst of cataclysmic social upheavals. Stories of violent student protests against the Vietnam War filled the media. Images from the huge Woodstock Music Festival that took place just 6 months before the Miami event near Bethel, New York, for many a striking symbol of the anti-establishment feelings of a whole generation of rebellious youth, were still firmly etched in the public's memory. Concert promoter Norman Johnson perhaps hoped my presence would neutralize at least some of the fierce opposition he had encountered from Miami officials. As I stepped onto the platform that Sunday morning, several thousand young people were lolling on the straw-covered ground or wandering around the concert site in the warm December sun, waiting for such groups as the Grateful Dead and Santana to make their appearance. A few in the audience were sleeping. The nonstop music had quit around 4 that morning. In order to get a feel for the event for a few hours the night before, I put on a simple disguise and slipped into the crowd. Though I was thankful for their youthful exuberance, I was burdened by their spiritual searching and emptiness. A bearded youth who had come all the way from California for the event recognized me. "Do me a favor," he said to me with a smile, "and say a prayer to thank God for good friends and good weed." Every evening at sunset, he confided to me, he got high on marijuana and other drugs. "You can also get high on Jesus," I replied. That Sunday morning, I came prepared to be shouted down, but instead I was greeted with scattered applause. Most listened politely as I spoke. I told the young people that I had been listening carefully to the message of their music. We reject your materialism, it seemed to proclaim, and we want something of the soul. Jesus was a nonconformist, I reminded them, and he could fill their souls and give them meaning and purpose in life. Tune into God today and let him give you faith. Turn on to his power. Afterward, 24 responded by visiting a tent on the grounds set up by a local church as a means of outreach. During the whole weekend, the pastor wrote me later, 350 young people made commitments to Christ, and 2,000 New Testaments were distributed. As I have reflected on my own calling as an evangelist, I frequently recall the words of Christianity's greatest evangelist, the Apostle Paul. It has always been my ambition to preach the gospel where Christ was not known. Romans 15:20. Paul not only spoke in houses of worship, but also felt equally at home preaching to crowds in the central marketplace in Athens, small groups on a riverbank or in a jail cell in Philippi, curiosity seekers in a rented public hall in Ephesus, and fellow passengers on the deck of a sinking ship off the Italian coast. I once told an interviewer that I would be glad to preach in hell itself if the devil would let me out again. My visit to the Miami Rock Festival was not an attempt to add variety to my schedule. True, it was not a typical setting for our ministry, but neither was it an unexpected setting, especially in light of the times. In some ways, in fact, it was symbolic of much of our ministry during the 1960s and early 1970s. As I look back, our schedule during those years was as packed as at any other time in our ministry, with large-scale crusades in dozens of cities across the world, from Los Angeles and Seoul to Rio de Janeiro and Hong Kong. Much of my time, in fact, was spent overseas, often visiting in depth areas that we had only touched earlier. Nevertheless, the rootlessness of the 60s generation burdened me greatly, and I was determined to do whatever I could to point young people to the one who alone gives lasting meaning and purpose to life. Whether it was at a rock festival in Miami, a spring break on the Fort Lauderdale beaches, or a university mission, almost everywhere we went, we sensed a deep hunger for spiritual reality on the part of many young people. Not all were open to the gospel, of course, but we still saw God redirect the paths of many who found in Christ the answer to their search. I cannot point to a single event or intellectual crisis that changed my mind on racial equality. Growing up in the rural South, I had adopted the attitudes of that region without much reflection, though I admired no one as much as Reese Brown, my father's black foreman on the dairy farm. As a boy, I also loved reading the Tarzan adventure books by Edgar Rice Burroughs, although even at that time it bothered me that white people were consistently portrayed in them as superior to blacks. At Wheaton College, I made friends with black students, and I recall vividly one of them coming to my room one day and talking with deep conviction about America's need for racial justice. Most influential, however, was my study of the Bible, leading me eventually to the conclusion that not only was racial inequality wrong, but Christians especially should demonstrate love toward all peoples. In 1953, during our crusade in Chattanooga, Tennessee, as the people were beginning to gather one night, I went into the arena and personally tore down the rope separating the white from the black sections, ropes that had been mandated according to the custom in those days by the local committee. My action caused the head usher to resign in anger right on the spot and raise some other hackles, but I did not back down. Civil rights were very much in the forefront in America during the 1960s and early 1970s. As the issue unfolded, I sometimes found myself under fire from both sides, extreme conservatives castigating me for doing too much, and extreme liberals blaming me for not doing enough. In reality, both groups tended to stand aloof from our evangelistic crusades. But those people who actively supported us understood very well our commitment to doing what we could through our evangelism to end the blight of racism. Early on, Dr. King and I spoke about his method of using nonviolent demonstrations to bring an end to racial segregation. "You stay in the stadiums, Billy," he said, "because you will have far more impact on the white establishment there than you would if you marched in the streets. Besides that, you have a constituency that will listen to you, especially among white people, who may not listen so much to me. But if a leader gets too far out in front of his people, they will lose sight of him and not follow him any longer." I followed his advice. Few events galvanized the whole issue of civil rights or caused such strong feelings on both sides as did the 1965 Selma March and the violence that followed in its wake. Shortly afterward, in April, President Johnson suggested that I go to Alabama as a gesture of peace and goodwill, and in April we held several rallies around the state, including one at Tuskegee Institute. During the long summer of 1965, America seemed on the brink of chaos. Immediately after the riots in the Watts neighborhood of Los Angeles, I toured the area with Dr. E.V. Hill, a respected black pastor in Watts, who later became a member of the BGEA board, and other community leaders. No doubt extremists on both sides exploited the situation for their own goals, but I was sickened by the violence and the widespread destruction we saw on every hand. There were no easy answers, I knew, but Dr. Hill and I both agreed that any solution that omitted the need for spiritual renewal could bring only temporary relief. Hatred and racism are fundamentally moral and spiritual problems. Much of my time during the 1960s and early 1970s was spent overseas. Two trips in particular brought us to nations torn by chronic strife and division. The first was our visit to Ireland in 1972. Long a hotbed of religious and political conflict between Protestants and Catholics, Northern Ireland was a virtual war zone as a result of bombings and armed attacks by the Provisional Wing of the Irish Republican Army. After careful investigation by Walter Smith, who had spent some of his boyhood years in Belfast, and others, we responded to an invitation from a broad-based group of Protestant pastors to make a private visit to Northern Ireland. No crusade meetings would be possible for security reasons, although I did preach in one church, but we felt that an expression of goodwill toward both sides might do something to diffuse the dangerous situation. We went to Northern Ireland only days after finishing a crusade in Birmingham, Alabama. The progress in racial harmony we saw there between our 1965 rallies and this crusade, 7 years later, encouraged us to believe that even in difficult places with long histories of conflict, love and goodwill have the power to overcome the barriers of the past. We arrived in Belfast on a Saturday night, and the next morning I joined our friend Arthur Blessett, an American evangelist who was carrying a large cross through the streets of Great Britain and Ireland. We went for a walk along Falls Road and Shank Hill Road, often seen as dividing lines between the warring factions. We had no security guards or police with us. The newspapers had displayed my picture prominently so people knew who I was. "How will I know if they're going to accept us?" I asked Arthur. "Well, if they do not, you will get a bullet in the back." His answer was hardly reassuring, but we prayed and committed the time to the Lord. Not too much further down the road, we encountered a roadblock manned by the British. We did not see the soldiers, but we saw their steely rifles poking through the sandbags. Shortly afterward, we heard a mighty explosion. We could not see its flash, but we certainly felt its impact. People poured out into the streets and ran in the direction of the noise. We joined the crowd and soon came upon the dreadful sight, bodies and pieces of bodies blown apart by a bomb. Three of the dead were apparently known terrorists handling the bomb, but certainly others were innocent bystanders. We tried to bring some measure of comfort to the chaotic scene. Several of the people recognized me. I was not wearing clerical garb, of course, but they insisted on calling me Father, begging me to give the last rites to the dead and the dying. It was not a time for theological distinctions. I knelt by each one and prayed for them. One woman said I was the first Protestant clergyman she had met. Many thanked us for coming. At that moment, the soldiers arrived, and one of them advised us to leave the scene as quickly as possible. More trouble was sure to develop, so we turned around and retraced our steps without further incident, without a bullet in our back, but with a profound sense of sadness at what had occurred. During the next few days, we met with a wide variety of people, including the governor, the Lord Grey of Naunton. In a meeting sponsored by both the Catholic and Protestant chaplains, students at the Queen's University listened attentively as I spoke about the power of Christ to change lives and fill our hearts with love. Especially memorable was a private meeting with Cardinal Conway, the Roman Catholic primate, at the Archbishop's Palace in Armagh. Protestant leaders had also been invited, and they confirmed what I had heard from others, that in spite of the division between Protestants and Catholics, the complex troubles in Ireland were not basically religious, but rather were historical and political in nature. Afterward, we went by train to Dublin in the Republic of Ireland. We were overwhelmed by the warmth of our reception. 2,000 invited guests came to an evening meeting at the Royal Dublin Concert Hall, and Chief Justice O'Daly presided at a breakfast for 450 the next morning. At one meeting, the MC, a Catholic priest, told how he had come to Christ through reading my book, Peace with God. Another meeting, this one at Milltown Park, the headquarters of the Jesuit order in Ireland, brought together clergy from all denominations. Of special interest was a secret meeting I had with the leader of the official wing of the IRA. The police advised against it, but I decided to go through with it anyway. Walter Smith and I were taken out the back door of our hotel and bundled into a car driven by two men with beards. Shortly afterward, we switched cars and were driven to a house in a working-class section of the city. The IRA leader we met there talked for almost an hour about the history of the conflicts in Ireland. Then we had tea, and I spoke about what Christ had done for me, and how I believed he could bring healing to the people of Northern Ireland if they would turn humbly to him. The next year, 1973, we went to South Africa. I had been invited there several times before, the first time being in my Youth for Christ days, but I had always refused to go. That country's strict apartheid policy meant that our audiences would have to be segregated. In the early 1970s, our friend Michael Cassidy, the founder of African Enterprise, detected some slight changes in his nation's policy and began to pursue the possibility of a Congress on Evangelism patterned after the 1966 Berlin Congress. He eventually was able to gain permission for a fully integrated conference embracing all races and virtually all Protestant denominations in South Africa, and I was invited by the organizing committee to speak twice at the event. On March 13th, the South African Congress on Mission and Evangelism convened in the coastal resort city of Durban for 10 days. All 700 of us, regardless of race, stayed in the same hotel. Some said it was the largest interracial meeting held to that date in South Africa. At first, I planned to speak only at the Congress. But to almost everyone's surprise, Cassidy was able to secure permission for a fully integrated evangelistic rally. I will never forget Saturday afternoon, March 17th, when 45,000 people of all races, half the people non-white, jammed King's Park Rugby Stadium and spilled over most of the playing field. Some of the committee members were almost overcome with joy by the sight of white ushers escorting non-whites to their seats. "Christianity is not a white man's religion," I stated, "and don't let anybody ever tell you that it's white or black. Christ belongs to all people. I went on to proclaim Christ as the only answer to the deepest needs of the human heart. At the invitation, 3,300 people completely filled the only open space in front of the platform. Additional hundreds could not be reached by counselors. Local papers said it was the largest multiracial crowd of any type in South Africa's history. The main Durban newspaper the next day carried the headline, "Apartheid Doomed," summarizing my statement at the press conference. I left South Africa convinced that apartheid was unchristian and unworkable. At the same time, I knew that South Africa's problem would not be solved instantly, any more than those in Northern Ireland or the United States. People sometimes assume that an evangelistic crusade is somehow a failure if the problems in a city or nation are not suddenly solved. But complex and long-standing problems are seldom solved overnight. Nevertheless, a start had been made, and for that we thanked God. One footnote to our work during the 1960s and early 1970s was the formation in 1973 of a special fund within the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association to bring humanitarian aid to places facing natural disasters or other emergencies. For many years, we made it a practice to give away a large part of our undesignated income for the support of other evangelistic enterprises and organizations in various parts of the world, including those trying to meet emergency needs. In 1973, we named our effort the World Emergency Fund. Over the years, I became more and more convinced of the importance of demonstrating our love through acts of compassion. I knew Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan, of course, and had always believed in our responsibility to do whatever we could as individuals to help those in need. As I studied and traveled, however, I came to realize we had a larger responsibility. My travels brought me face to face with a stark reality of human suffering and with the fact that many millions of people live on the knife edge of starvation or chronic illness or disaster. We also realized that compassionate help often opened the door to opportunities in evangelism as people saw Christ's love in action. I recall, for example, the earthquake in Guatemala in 1976. At the time, Ruth and I were in Mexico, where she was recovering from an illness. As soon as I heard of the disaster, I contacted our board to see what we could do through the World Emergency Fund. Then we arranged to travel to the devastated areas. The president of Guatemala put two helicopters at our disposal. His son traveled with us, along with Cliff and a friend of ours, the Argentine-born evangelist, Luis Palau. When we touched down in San Martin, Ilotepec, we saw at once that virtually every building had been destroyed. Of the town's 18,000 residents, 3,800 were dead in the ruins. Another 4,000 were badly wounded, but there was almost no medical help. Ruth and I felt utterly helpless as we watched thousands wandering about in a daze looking for food or lost relatives. Back in Guatemala City, I spoke to 500 Christian leaders and missionaries to assure them of our prayers and support. We were meeting in the partially destroyed Central Presbyterian Church. Even as I was talking, a sharp aftershock hit and pieces of the ceiling began to fall on us. The clergy got up and ran out, thinking it might be another earthquake. Later that day, I was invited to speak on the National Television Network. BGEA, through the World Emergency Fund, flew in a dozen plane loads of food and medicine to help with the relief effort. As in almost every other emergency situation where we have tried to help, we worked with established organizations and local Christian agencies to assure the supplies went where they were most needed.